The machines permitting, we'll reconvene for the second session. This evening, Hillis Miller will chair. However, first, a few announcements. Mr. Vernon, Jean-Pierre Vernon, will read his paper at the end of the program, that is to say, the second session is coming Friday. This means that we began by being interrogated with a myth, and we end again with an interrogation, mutual interrogation of Greek tragedy. Tonight, I think you'll find, because of the weather, that the bus available will be of some help. It'll be waiting in front of the library at the end of the sessions for those of you who are going back to the Belvedere. For others who need rides, we'll try to scatter about and see if we can offer you transportation. The sessions tomorrow will again have transportation provided from the Belvedere, and the dining arrangements will be the same as today. I think that Professor Miller will ask the members of the discussion panel to identify themselves, but we have a slightly different arrangement in terms of discussion tonight. There is now a portable microphone for the use of anyone in the back of the room who feels that there's been a coupage between two groups. However, we'll observe the same protocols initially, which is to say that the conferencier and the discussion panel have the duty or pleasure of opening the discussion, and then this discussion will circulate freely through the room. Thank you very much, Professor Miller.
Thank you. Georges Boulez of the University of Zurich, our speaker this evening, means two things to us here at Hopkins. On the one hand, he's an important European literary critic, leader of a school of literary criticism, and spokesman at this international symposium for that criticism. On the other hand, he's an old colleague of ours, someone we remember seeing daily, talking to and listening to over a wonderful period of years when he left his mark on the humanities group at Hopkins and on the direction of our literary studies here. And it's as much in that second capacity as in the first that gives me so much pleasure in welcoming him back home with open arms and in introducing him tonight to speak on the subject of criticism and the experience of interiority, Professor Poulet.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, at the beginning of Mallarmé's unfinished story, Igiture, there is the description of an empty room, in the middle of which, on a table, there is an open book. This seems to me the situation of every book until someone comes and begins to read it. Books are objects. On a table, on shelves, on store windows, they wait for someone to come and deliver them from their materiality, from their immobility. When I see them on display, I look at them as I would at animals for sale, kept in little cages and so obviously hoping for a buyer. For there is no doubting it, animals do know that their fate depends on a human intervention, thanks to which they will be delivered from the shame of being treated as objects. Isn't the same true of books? Made of paper and ink, they lie where they are put until the moment someone shows an interest in them. They wait. Are they aware that an act of man might suddenly transform their existence? They appear to be lit up with that hope. Read me, they seem to say. I find it hard to resist their appeal. No, books are not just objects among others. This feeling they give me, I sometimes have it with other objects. I have it, for example, with vases and statues. It would never occur to me to walk around a sewing machine or to look at the underside of a plate. I'm quite satisfied with the face they present to me. But statues make me want to circle around them. Vases make me want to turn them in my hands. I wonder why. Isn't it because they give me the illusion that there is something in them which, from a different angle, I might be able to see? Neither vase nor statue seems fully revealed by the unbroken perimeter of its surfaces. In addition to the surfaces, it must have an interior. What this interior might be, that is what intrigues me and makes me circle around them as though looking for the entrance to a secret chamber. But there is no such entrance, save for the mouth of the vase, which is not a true entrance, since it gives only access to a little space in which I can put flowers. So the vase and the statue are closed. They oblige me to remain outside. We can have no true rapport. Whence my sense of uneasiness? So much for statues and vases. I hope books are not like them. Buy a vase, take it home, put it on a table on or your mantle, and after a while, it will allow itself to be made part of your household. But it will be no less a vase for that. On the other hand, take a book, and you will find it offering, opening itself. It is this openness of the book which I find so moving. A book is not shut in by its contours. It's not walled up as in a fortress. It asks nothing better than to exist outside itself or to let you exist in it. In short, the extraordinary fact in the case of a book is the falling away of the barriers between you and it. You are inside it, it is inside you, there is no longer either outside or inside. Such is the initial phenomenon produced whenever I take up a book and begin to read it. At the precise moment that I see surging out of the object I hold open before me, a quantity of significations which my mind grasps, I realize that what I hold in my hand is no longer just an object, or even simply a living thing. I am aware of a rational being, of a consciousness, the consciousness of another, no different from the one I automatically assume in every human being I encounter, except that in this case, the consciousness is open to me, welcomes me, lets me look deep inside itself, and even allows me, with unheard of license, to think what it thinks and feel what it feels. Unheard of, I say. Unheard of first is the disappearance of the object. Where is the book I held in my hands? It is still there, and at the same time, it is there no longer. It is nowhere. That object, holy object, that thing made of paper, as there are things made of metal or porcelain, that object is no more, or at least it is as if it no longer existed, so long as I read the book. For the book is no longer a material reality. It has become a series of words, of images, of ideas, which in their turn begin to exist. And where is this new existence? Surely not in the paper object, nor surely in external space. There is only one place left for this new existence, my own innermost self. How has this come about? By what means, through whose intercession? How can I open my own mind so completely to what is usually shut out of it? I do not know, and only that while reading, I perceive in my mind a number of signification that which have made themselves at home there. Doubtless, they are still objects, images, ideas, words, objects of my thought. And yet, from this point of view, there is an enormous difference. For the book, like the vase, like the statue, like the table I was speaking of, was an object among others, residing in the external world, the world which objects ordinarily inhabit exclusively in their own society, or each on its own, in no need of being thought by my thought. Whereas, in this interior world, where, like fish in an aquarium, words, images, and ideas disport themselves, these mental entities, in order to exist, need the shelter which I provide. They are dependent on my consciousness. This dependence is at once a disadvantage and an advantage. As I have just observed, it is the privilege of exterior objects to dispense with any interference from the mind. All they ask is to be let alone. They manage by themselves. But the same is surely not true of interior objects. By definition, they are condemned to change their very nature, condemned to lose their materiality. They become images, ideas, words, that is to say, purely mental entities. In sum, in order to exist as mental objects, they must relinquish their existence as real objects. On the one hand, this is cause for regret. As soon as I replace my direct perception of reality by the words of a book, of the book I read, I deliver myself bound hand and foot to the omnipotence of fiction. I say farewell to what is in order to feign believe in what is not. I surround myself with fictitious beings. I become the prey of language. There is no escaping this takeover. Language surrounds me with its unreality. On the other hand, the transmutation through language of reality into a fictional equivalent has undeniable advantages. The universe of fiction is infinitely more elastic than the world of objective reality. It lends itself to any use. It yields with little resistance to the importunities of the mind. Moreover, and of all its benefits, I find this the most appealing, this interior universe constituted by language does not seem radically opposed to the me who thinks it. Doubtless, what I glimpse through the words are mental forms not divested of an appearance of objectivity, but they do not seem to be of another nature than my mind, which thinks them. They are objects, but subjectified objects. In short, since everything has become part of my mind, thanks to the intervention of language, the opposition between the subject and its objects has been considerably attenuated. And thus, the greatest advantage of literature is that I am persuaded by it, that I am freed from my usual sense of incompatibility between my consciousness and its object. So this is the remarkable transformation wrought in me through the act of reading. Not only does it cause the physical objects around me to disappear, including the very book I am reading, but it replaces those external objects with a congeries of mental objects in close rapport with my own consciousness. And yet, the very intimacy in which I now live with my objects is going to present me with new problems. The most curious of these is the following. I am someone who happens to have as objects of his own thoughts which are part of a book I am reading, and which are therefore the cogitations of another. They are the thoughts of another, and yet it is I who am their subject. The situation is even more astonishing than the one noted above. I am thinking the thoughts of another. This merits reflection. In a certain sense, I must recognize that no idea really belongs to me. Ideas belong to no one. They pass from one mind to another as coins pass from hand to hand. Consequently, nothing could be more misleading than the attempt to define a consciousness by the ideas which it utters or entertains. But whatever these ideas may be, however strong the tie which binds them to their source, however transitory may be their sojourn in my own mind, so long as I entertain them, I assert myself as subject of these ideas. I am the subjective principle for whom the ideas serve for the time being as predications. Furthermore, this subjective principle can in no wise be conceived as a predication, as something which is discussed, referred to. It is I who think, who contemplate, who am engaged in speaking. In short, it is never a he, but an I. Now, what happens when I read a book? Am I then the subject of a series of predications which are not my predications? That is impossible, perhaps even a contradiction in terms. I feel sure that as soon as I think something, that something becomes in some indefinable way my own. Whatever I think is a part of my mental world. And yet, here I am thinking a thought which manifestly belongs to another mental world, which is being thought in me just as though it did not exist. Already, the notion is inconceivable and seems even more so if I reflect that since every thought must have a subject to think it, this thought which is alien to me and yet in me must also have in me a subject which is alien in me, alien to me. It all happens then as though reading were the act by which a thought managed to bestow itself within me with a subject not myself. Whenever I read, I mentally pronounce an I, and yet the I which I pronounce is not myself. This is true even when the hero of a novel is presented in the third person, like Julien Sorel in The Rouge et Noir, and even when there is no hero and nothing but reflections or propositions or divagations. For as soon as something is presented as thought, there has to be a thinking subject with whom, at least for the time being, I identify for getting myself alienated from myself. Je est un autre, said Rimbaud, another I who has replaced my own and who will continue to do so as long as I read. Reading is just that, a way of giving way, not only to a host of alien words, images, ideas, but also to the very alien principle which utters them and shelters them. When I am absorbed in reading, a second self takes over, a self which thinks and feels for me. Withdrawn in some recess of myself, do I then silently witness this dispossession? Do I derive from it some comfort? Or, on the contrary, a kind of anguish? However that may be, someone else holds the center of the stage, and the question which imposes itself, which I am absolutely obliged to ask myself, is this: who is this usurper who occupies the forefront? What is this mind who all by himself alone fills my consciousness, and who, when I say I, is indeed that I? There is an immediate answer to this question, perhaps too easy an answer and not too good. This I who thinks in me when I read a book is the I of the one who writes the book. When I read Baudelaire or Racine, it is really Baudelaire or Racine who thinks, feels, allows himself to be read within me. Thus, a book is not only a book, it is the means by which an author actually preserves his ideas, his feelings, his modes of dreaming and living. It is his means of saving his identity from death. Such an interpretation of reading is not false. It seems to justify what is commonly called the biographical explication or fallacy. Indeed, every word of literature is impregnated with the mind of the one who wrote it. As he makes us read it, he awakens in us the analogue of what he thought or felt. To understand a literary work, then, is to let the individual who wrote it reveal himself to us in us. It is not the biography which explicates the work, but rather, in this case, the work which enables us to understand the biography. But biographical interpretation is misleading. It is true that there is an analogy between the works of an author and the experiences of his life. Yet the subject which presides over the work can exist only in the work. To be sure, nothing is unimportant for understanding the work. And a mass of biographical, bibliographical, textual, general, critical information is indispensable to me. All right. And yet, this knowledge does not coincide with the internal knowledge of the work. Whatever may be the sum of the information I acquire on Baudelaire or Racine, in whatever degree of intimacy I may live with their genius, I am aware that this contribution does not suffice to illuminate for me in its own inner meaning, in its formal perfection, in its subjective principle, the subjective principle which animates it, the particular work of Baudelaire or of Racine, the reading of which now absorbs me. At this moment, what matters to me is to live from the inside a certain identity with the work and the work alone. It could hardly be otherwise. Nothing external to the work could possibly share the extraordinary claim which the work now exerts on me. It is there within me not to send me back outside itself to its author, nor to his other writings, but on the contrary, to keep my attention riveted on itself. It is the work which traces in me the very boundaries with which this consciousness will define itself. It is the work which forces on me a series of mental objects and creates in me a network of words beyond which, for the time being, there will be no room for other mental objects or for other words. And it is the work, finally, which, not satisfied thus with defining the content of my consciousness, takes hold of it, appropriates it, and makes of it that I, which, from one end of my reading to the other, presides over the unfolding of the work or the single work which I am reading. And so the work forms the temporary mental substance which fills my consciousness. And it is, moreover, that consciousness, the I subject, the continued consciousness of what is revealing itself within the interior of the work. Such is the characteristic condition of every world which has summoned back into existence by placing my consciousness at its disposal. I give it not only existence, but awareness of existence. And so I ought not to hesitate to recognize that so long as it is animated by this vital in-breathing inspired by the act of reading, a work of literature becomes, at the expense of the reader whose own life it more or less suspends, a sort of human being that is a mind conscious of itself and constituting itself in me as the subject of its objects. The work lives its own life within me. In a certain sense, it thinks itself and it even gives itself a meaning within me. This strange displacement of myself by the work deserves to be examined even more closely. If the work thinks itself in me, does this mean that during a complete loss of consciousness of my part, another thinking entity invades me, taking advantage of my unconsciousness in order to think itself without me being able to think it? Obviously not. The annexation of my consciousness by another, the other which is the work, in no way implies that I am the victim of any deprivation of consciousness. Everything happens on the contrary, as though from the moment I become a prey to what I read, I begin to share the use of my consciousness with this being whom I have tried to define and who is the conscious subject ensconced at the heart of the work. He and I, we start having a common consciousness. Doubtless, within this community of feeling, the parts played by each of us are not of equal importance. The consciousness inherent in the work is active and potent. It occupies the foreground. It is clearly related to its own world, to objects which are its objects. In opposition, I myself, although conscious of what it may be conscious of, I play a much more humble role, content to record passively all that is going on in me. A lag takes place, a sort of schizoid distinction between what I feel and what the other feels, a confused awareness of delay, so that the work seems first to think by itself and then to inform me what it has thought. Thus, I often have the impression while reading of simply witnessing an action which at the same time concerns and yet does not concern me. This provokes a certain feeling of surprise within me. I am a consciousness astonished by an existence which is not mine, by which I experience as though it were mine. This astonished consciousness is, in fact, the consciousness of the critic. It is the consciousness of a being who is allowed to apprehend as its own what is happening in the consciousness of another being. Aware of a certain gap, disclosing a feeling of identity, but of identity within a difference, critical consciousness does not necessarily imply the total disappearance of the critic's mind in the mind to be criticized. From the partial and hesitant approximation of some critics like Jacques Rivière to the exalted, digressive, and triumphant approximation of another critic like Charles Dubos, for instance, criticism can pass through a whole series of nuances which we would be well advised to study. That is what I now propose to do, by discovering the various forms of identification and non-identification to be found in recent critical writing in French literature, I shall be able perhaps to give a better account of the variations of which this relationship between criticizing object, criticizing subject, and criticized object is capable. Let me take a first example. In the case of the critic, I shall speak first of this fusion of two consciousnesses is barely suggested. It is an uncertain movement of the mind toward an object which remains more or less hidden. Whereas in the perfect identification of two consciousnesses, each sees itself reflected in the other. In this instance, the critical consciousness can at best attempt but to draw closer to a reality which must remain forever veiled. In this attempt, it uses the only mediators available to it in this quest, that is the senses. And since sight, the most intellectual of the five senses, seems in this particular case to come up against the basic opacity, the critical mind must approach its goal blindly through the tactile exploration of surfaces, through a groping exploration of the material world which separates the critical mind from its object. Thus, despite the immense effort on the part of the sympathetic intelligence to lower itself to a level where it can, however lamely, make some progress in its quest toward the consciousness of the other, this enterprise is destined to failure. One senses that the unfortunate critic is condemned never to fulfill adequately his role as reader. He stumbles, he puzzles, he questions awkwardly a language which is condemned never to read with ease. Or rather, in trying to read the language, he uses a key which enables him to translate but a fraction of the text. This critic is Jacques Rivière, who for a long time was the editor of the famous French review, Nouvelle Revue Française. And yet, it is from this failure of Jacques Rivière that a much later critic will derive a more successful method of approaching a text. With this later critic, as with Rivière, the whole project begins with an attempt at identification on the most basic level. But this most primitive level is the one in which flows from mind to mind a current which has only to be followed. To identify with the work means here for the critic to undergo the same experiences beginning with the most elementary, on the level of indistinct thought, of sensations, emotions, images, obsessions of preconscious life. It is possible for the critic to repeat within himself that life of which the work affords the first version, inexhaustibly revealing and suggestive. And yet such an imitation could not take place in a domain so hard to define without the aid of a powerful auxiliary. This auxiliary is, of course, language. There is no critical identification which is not prepared, realized, and incarnated through the agency of language. The deepest sentient life hidden in the recesses of another's thoughts could never be truly transposed save for the mediation of words which allow a whole series of equivalences to arise. To describe this phenomenon as it takes place in the criticism, which of which I am speaking now, I can no longer be content with the usual distinctions between, say, the signifiant and the signifié, to use two terms very much the fashion now. For what would it mean here to say that the language of the critic signifies the language of the literary work? There is not just equation, similitude. Words have attained a veritable power of recreation. They are a sort of material entity, solid and three-dimensional, thanks to which a certain life of the senses is reborn, finding in a network of verbal connotations the very conditions necessary for its replication. In other words, the language of criticism here dedicates itself to the business of miming, of mimicking physically the apperceptual world of the author. Strangely enough, the language of this sort of mimetic criticism becomes even more tangible, more tactile than the author's own. The poetry of the critic becomes more poetic than the poet's. This verbal mimesis, consciously exaggerated, is in no way servile, nor does it tend at all toward the pastiche. And yet it can reach its object only insofar as object, as the object is deeply enmeshed in almost confounded with physical matter. This form of criticism is thus able to provide an unmillable equivalent of the vital substratum which underlies all thought, and yet it seems incapable of attaining and expressing thought itself. This criticism is both helped and hindered by the language which it employs. Helped, insofar as this language allows it to express the sensuous life in its original state, where it is almost impossible to distinguish between subject and object. And yet hindered, too, because this language, too congealed and opaque, does not lend itself to analysis, and because the subjectivity which it evokes and describes is as though forever bogged or mired in its object. And so the activity of criticism in this case is somehow incomplete in spite of its remarkable successes. Identification relatively to objects is accomplished almost too well. Relatively to subjectivity, it is simply sketched. This, then, is, to my mind, the criticism of Jean-Pierre Richard. In its extreme form, in the abolition of any subject whatsoever, this criticism seems to extract from a literary work a certain condensed matter, a material essence. But what then would be a criticism which would be the very reverse, which would abolish the object and extract from the text their most subjective elements? To conceive such a criticism, I must leap to the opposite extreme. I imagine a critical language which would attempt deliberately to strip the literary language of anything concrete. In such a criticism, it would be the artful aim of every line, of every sentence, of every metaphor, of every word, to reduce to the near nothingness of abstraction the images of the real world reflected by literature. If literature, by definition, is already a transposition of the real into the unreality of verbal conception, then the critical act in this case will constitute a transposition of this transposition, thus raising to the second power the derealization of being through language. In this way, the mind puts the maximum distance between its thought and what is. Thanks to this withdrawal and to the consequent dematerialization of every object thus pushed to the vanishing point, the universe represented in this criticism seems not so much the equivalent of the perceivable world or of its literary representation, as rather its image crystallized through a process of rigorous intellectualization. Here, criticism is no longer mimesis. It is the reduction of all literary forms to the same level of insignificance. In short, what survives this attempted annihilation of literature by the critical act? Nothing, perhaps, save a consciousness ceaselessly confronting the hollowness of mental objects which yield without resistance, and an absolute transparent language which, by coating all objects with the same clear glaze, makes them, comme des feuilles sous ta glace au trou profond, I quote Mallarmé, make them appear to be infinitely far away. Thus, the language of this criticism plays a role exactly opposite to the function it has in Jean-Pierre Richard's criticism. It does indeed bring about the unification of critical thought with the mental world revealed by the literary work, but it brings it about at the expense of the work. Everything is finally annexed by the dominion of a consciousness detached from any object, a hypercritical consciousness functioning all alone somewhere in the void. Is there any need to say that this hypercriticism is the critical thought of Maurice Blanchot? I found it useful to compare the criticism of Jean-Pierre Richard to the criticism of Blanchot. I learned from this confrontation that the critic's linguistic apparatus can, just as he chooses, bring him closer to the work under consideration, or can remove him from it indefinitely. If he so wishes, he can approximate very closely the work in question, thanks to a verbal mimesis which transposes into the critic's language the sensuous themes of the work. Or else, he can make language a pure crystallizing agent, an absolute translucence, which, suffering no opacity to exist between subject and object, promotes the exercise of the cognitive power on the part of the subject, while at the same time accentuating in the object those characters which emphasize its infinite distance from the subject. In the first of the two cases, criticism achieves a remarkable complicity, but at the risk of losing its minimum lucidity. In the second case, it results in the most complete dissociation, the maximum lucidity thereby achieved only confirms a separation instead of a union. Thus, criticism seems to oscillate between two possibilities: a union without comprehension, a comprehension without union. I may identify so completely with what I am reading that I lose consciousness not only of myself, but also of that other consciousness which lives within the world. Its proximity blinds me by blocking my prospect. But I may, on the other hand, separate myself so completely from what I am contemplating that the thought thus removed to a distance assumes the aspect of a being with whom I may never establish any relationship whatever. In either case, the act of reading has delivered me from egocentricity. Another thought inhabits me or haunts me. But in the first case, I lose myself into that alien world, and in the other, we keep our distance and refuse to identify. Extreme closeness and extreme detachment have then the same regrettable effect of making me fall short of the total critical act. That is to say, the exploration of that mysterious interrelationship which, through the mediation of reading and of language, is established to our mutual satisfaction between the work read and myself. Thus, extreme proximity and extreme separation each have grave disadvantages, and yet they have their privileges as well. Sensuous thought is privileged to move at once to the heart of the work and to share its own life. Clear thought is privileged to confer on its objects the highest degree of intelligibility. Two sorts of insight are here distinguishable and mutually exclusive. There is penetration by the senses and penetration by the reflective consciousness. Now, rather than contrasting these two forms of critical activity, would there not be some way, I wonder, not of practicing them simultaneously, which would be impossible, but at least of combining them through a kind of reciprocation and alternation? Is not this perhaps the method used today by Jean Starobinsky? For instance, it would not be difficult to find in his work a number of texts which relate him to Maurice Blanchot. Like Blanchot, he displays exceptional lucidity and an acute awareness of distance. And yet he does not quite abandon himself to Blanchot's habitual pessimism. On the contrary, Starobinsky seems inclined to optimism, even at times to pleasant utopianism. Staro's intellect in this respect is analogous to that of Rousseau, yearning for immediate transparency of all beings to each other, which would enable them to understand each other in an ecstatic happiness. From this point of view, is the ideal of criticism not precisely represented by the fête citadine or the fête champêtre? There is a milieu or a moment in the rustic or the street feast in which everyone communicates with everyone else, in which hearts are open like books. On a more modest scale, doesn't the same phenomenon occur in reading? Does not one being open its innermost self? Is not the other being enchanted by this opening? In the criticism of Starobinsky, we often find that crystalline tempo of music, that pure delight in understanding, that perfect sympathy between an intelligence which enters and that intelligence which welcomes it. In such moments of harmony, there is no longer any exclusion, no inside or outside. Contrary to Blanchot's belief, perfect translucence does not result in separation. On the contrary, with Starobinsky, all is perfect agreement, a joy shared, the pleasure of the understanding and of being understood. Moreover, such pleasure, however intellectual it may be, is not here exclusively a pleasure of the mind. For the relationship established on this level between author and critic is not a relationship between pure minds. It is rather between incarnate beings, and the particularities of their physical existence constitute not obstacles to understanding, but rather a complex of supplementary signs, a veritable language which must be deciphered and which enhances mutual comprehension. Thus, for Starobinsky, as much physician as critic, there is a reading of bodies which is likened to the reading of minds. It is not exactly of the same nature, nor does it bring the intelligence to bear on the same area or sector of human knowledge, but for the critic who practices it, this criticism provides the opportunity for a reciprocating exchange between different types of learning, which have perhaps different degrees of transparency. Starobinsky's criticism then displays great flexibility. Rising at times to the heights of metaphysics, it does not disdain the farther reaches of the subconscious. It is sometimes intimate, sometimes detached. It assumes all the degrees of identification and non-identification. But its final movement seems to consist in a sort of withdrawal by contradistinction with the earliest accord. After an initial intimacy with the object under study, this criticism has finally to detach itself, to move on, but this time in solitude. Let us not see this withdrawal as a failure of sympathy, but rather as a way of avoiding the encumbrances of too prolonged a life in common. Above all, we discern an acute need of to establish bearings, to adopt the judicious perspective, to assess the fruits of proximity by examining them at a distance. Thus, Starobinsky's criticism always ends with a view from afar, or rather from above, for while moving away, it has also moved imperceptibly toward a dominating, a surplombant position. Thus, does this mean that Starobinsky's criticism, like Blanchot, is doomed to end in a philosophy of separation? This, in a way, must be considered. And it is no coincidence that Starobinsky treats with special care the themes of melancholy and nostalgia. His criticism always concludes with a double farewell. But this farewell is exchanged by two beings who have begun by living together, and the one left behind continues to be illuminated by the critical intellect which moves on. The sole fault with which I might reproach such criticism is the excessive ease with which it penetrates what it illuminates. By dint of seeing in literary works only the thoughts which inhabit them, Starobinsky's criticism somehow passes through their forms, not neglecting them, it is true, but without pausing on the way. Under its action, literary works lose their opacity, their solidity, their objective dimension, like those palace walls which become transparent in certain fairy tales. And if it is true that the ideal act of criticism must cease and reproduce that certain relationship between an object and a mind which is the work itself, how could the act of criticism succeed when it suppresses one of the terms of this relationship? My search must continue then for a criticism in which this relationship subsists. Could it perhaps be the criticism of Marcel Raymond and Jean Rousset, the two masters of what has been called the School of Geneva? Raymond's criticism always recognizes the presence of a double reality, both mental and formal. It strives to comprehend almost simultaneously an inner experience and a perfected form. On the one hand, no one allows himself to be absorbed with such complete self-forgetfulness into the thought of another. But the other thought is grasped not at its highest, but at its most obscure, at its cloudiest point, at the point at which it is reduced to being a mere self-awareness scarcely perceived by the being which entertains it, and which yet to the eyes of the critic seems the sole means of access by which he can penetrate within the precincts of the alien mind. But Raymond's criticism presents another aspect, which is the reverse of this confused identification of the critic's thought with the thought criticized. It is then the reflective contemplation of formal reality, which is the work itself. The work stands before the critical intelligence as a perfected object, which is at the same time an enigma, an external thing existing in itself, and with which there is no possibility of identification nor of inside knowledge. Thus, Raymond perceives sometimes a subject, sometimes an object. The subject is pure mind. It is a sheer, indefinable presence, an almost inchoate entity, into which, by very virtue of its absence of form, it becomes possible for the critic's mind to penetrate. The work, on the contrary, exists only within a definite form, but this definition limits it and closes it within its own contours, constraining at the same time the mind which studies it to remain on the outside. So that if, on the one hand, the critical thought of Raymond tends to lose itself within an undefined subjectivity, on the other, it tends to come to stop before an impenetrable objectivity. Now, is it then possible to go one step further? This is what is attempted by Jean Rousset, a former student of Raymond and perhaps his closest friend. He also dedicates himself to the task of discerning the structure of a work as well as the depth of an experience. Only what essentially matters to him is to establish a connection between the objective reality of the work and the organizing power which gives it shape. A work is not explained for him, as for the structuralist, by the exclusive interdependence of the objective elements which compose it. It does not see in it a fortuitous combination, interpreted a posteriori as if it were an a priori organization. There is not in his eyes any system of the work without a principle of systematization which operates in correlation with that work and which is even included in it. In short, there is no spider web without a center which is the spider. On the other hand, it is not a question of going from the work to the psychology of the author, but of going back within the sphere of the work from the objective elements systematically arranged to the power of organization inherent in the work itself, as if the latter showed itself to be an intentional consciousness determining its arrangements and solving its problems. So that it would be scarcely be an abuse of terms to say that it speaks by means of its structural elements, an authentic language, thanks to which it discloses itself and means nothing but itself. Such then is the critical enterprise of Jean Rousset. It sets itself to use the objective elements of the work in order to attain beyond them a reality not formal nor objective, written down, however, in forms and expressing itself by means of them. Thus, the understanding of forms must not limit itself merely to the recording of their objective aspect, as Faucillon demonstrated from the point of view of art history. There is a life of forms perceptible not only in the historic development which they display from epoch to epoch, but within each single work in the movement by which forms tend therein sometimes to stabilize and become static, and sometimes, on the contrary, to change into one another. Thus, the two contradictory forces which are always at work in any literary writing, the will to stability and the protean impulse, help us to perceive by their interplay how much forms are dependent on what Coleridge called a shaping power, which determines them, replaces them, and transcends them. The teaching of Raymond finds then its most satisfying success in the critical method of Jean Rousset, a method which leads the seeker from the continuously changing frontiers of form to what is beyond form. It is fitting then to conclude here this inquiry, since it has achieved its goal, namely to describe, relying on a series of more or less adequate examples, a critical method having as its guiding principle the relation between subject and object. Yet there remains a last difficulty. In order to establish the interrelationship between subject and object, which is the principle of all creative work and of the understanding of it, two ways, at least theoretically, are opened, one leading from the objects to the subject, the other from the subject to the object. Thus we saw Raymond and Rousset, through perception of the objective structures of a literary work, strive to attain the subjective principle which upholds it. But by that, they seem to recognize the precedence of the subject on this object. What Raymond and Rousset are searching for in the objective and formal aspects of the work is something which is previous to the work and on which the work depends for its very existence. So that the method, which leads from the object to the subject, does, after all, not differ radically from the one which leads from subject to object, since it does really consist in going from subject to subject through the object. Yet there is there the risk of overlooking an important part. The aim of criticism is not achieved merely by the understanding of the part played by the subject in its interrelation with its object. When reading a literary work, there is a moment when it seems to me that the subject present in the work disengages itself from all that surrounds it and stands alone. Had I not once the intuition of this when visiting the Scuola di San Rocco in Venice, one of the highest summits of art, where there are assembled so many paintings of the same painter, Tintoretto. When looking at all these masterpieces brought there together and revealing so manifestly their unity of inspiration, I had suddenly the impression of having reached the common essence present in all the works of a great master, an essence which I was not able to perceive except when emptying my mind of all the particular images created by the artist. I became then aware of a subjective power at work in all these pictures, and yet never so clearly understood by my mind than when I had forgotten all their particular figurations. One may ask oneself, what is this subject, standing in isolation at the end of all critical examination of a literary work? Is it the individual genius of the artist, visibly present in his work, yet having an invisible life independently of the work? Or is it, as Valéry thinks, an anonymous and abstract consciousness presiding in its aloofness to the operations of all more concrete consciousnesses? Whatever it may be, I am constrained to acknowledge that all subjective activity present in a literary work is not entirely explained by its relationship with forms and objects within the work. There is in the work a mental activity profoundly engaged in objective forms, and there is, at another level, forsaking all forms, a subject which reveals itself to itself and to me in its transcendence relatively to all which is reflected in it. At this point, no object can any longer express it, no structure can any longer define it, It is exposed in its ineffability and in its fundamental indeterminacy. Such is perhaps the reason why the critic, in his elucidation of works, is haunted by this transcendence of mind. It seems then that criticism, in order to accompany the mind in this effort of detachment from itself, needs to annihilate, or at least momentarily to forget, the objective elements of the work and to elevate itself to the apprehension of a subjectivity without objectivity.